taking up those words of Jesus. Let's just take it into a prayer for a moment. Father, thank you for sending us Jesus, who gives us a unique perspective on our world and on us. May we know what would bring us peace. May our eyes be opened and our ears too. For we ask this in your name. Amen. A vicar was visiting an elderly woman from his congregation, and as he sat down on the couch, he noticed on the coffee table in front of him a bowl full of peanuts. And because he'd been so busy visiting, he hadn't had time to have any lunch, so he's quite peckish. So he said to the elderly woman, he says, "Do you mind if I just take a few of these, because I'm feeling a bit peckish?" And the woman said, "Oh, vicar, no problem. Help yourself. Have as many as you like." So they talked for about an hour about whatever it was he'd come to speak to her about. And as he got up to go, he suddenly realized, to his extreme embarrassment, that he'd eaten all the peanuts. He'd just been picking away, and he hadn't noticed, and they were all gone. And so he apologized. He said, I'm terribly sorry, he said, "but I've eaten all of your peanuts." And the woman said, "Oh, that's all right. Ever since I lost my teeth, all I can do is suck the chocolate off them." It's no fun getting old, is it? But there are some advantages. And one of these is that you're able to see things from a different perspective. The roles, if you like, kind of reverse. For example, when I was a child and when I did something wrong and was punished for it or told off for it, I found it very hard sometimes to understand what all the fuss was about. You know, why should my parents be so upset when I was late for tea, or I came back after dark instead of the time they told me to, or I told a fib or something? I don't understand what all the fuss is about. But now that I am a parent and I see things from a different perspective, then I understand a little bit more why it is the parents do get upset, because they are worried. And the reason we lay into our children sometimes is partly a relief because they got them safely, but partly because we don't want them to do that again, just in case they get abducted or they get hurt or they get knocked down or so on, or they develop a lifestyle that is not a good one. And what I want to do is use that idea today, this idea of changing perspectives, to take a fresh look at the subject of sin, which, let's be honest, has got a really bad press, isn't it, sin? It's not a good thing. I want to try and look at it from God's perspective. If you like, I want to stand behind God, not that that's possible, look over his shoulder and see the world and see sin particularly in the way that he looks at it. And why, I'm trying to understand, if you like, why he gets upset by it. And why did he feel the need to act so extremely in sending his son Jesus to die for us and to take away that sin? And to help us, I want to look at each of the morning readings briefly. And I want to start with that reading from Luke, where he tells us about, he shows us Jesus looking down on the city of Jerusalem, a city that was very soon to turn its back on him completely. A city that was actually going to welcome him one minute, and the next minute deliver him up for crucifixion. And as he looks down on this city, and knowing what's coming ahead, he weeps. And in fact, the word means he wept audibly. He wept fairly loudly. You know, you knew by listening to him that he was deeply upset about what he saw. And the sin here, if you like, is the people of God, people of God supposedly, rejecting God's love, rejecting God, rejecting his love, and rejecting his hand of peace, his desire to help them. If you, even you, had only known this day what would bring you peace, which is what he wants to bring, but now it is hidden from your eyes, you're blind to it. And what Jesus is referring here, of course, is his concern that the sin of the people, the rejection, the constant rejection of God, would lead to self-destruction. He says, "The days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you and hem you in on every side. They will dash you to the ground, you and the children within your walls. And they will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you. And we know from history that's what happened in AD 70. The Roman leader Titus surrounded the city after rebellion, surrounds it with three legions of Roman soldiers. He sets up a rampart. He couldn't get in any other way, so he eventually built earthen ramparts against the wall so that his soldiers could pour in. And Josephus, who is the Jewish historian and actually was engaged by the Romans to try and broker peace with the rebels, and three times they said no. He tells us that eventually over 1 million people, including women and children, maybe an exaggeration, but it was a lot of people, 1 million people, he says, were put to death. 97,000 people were arrested and were crucified. The temple was destroyed. In fact, it was so bad, the whole place, that you could walk through it and hardly see a wall standing. And Jesus could see it. This was where their rebellion, their rejection was leading them. And as he sees the direction they're going, he weeps over them. They preferred war to peace. They preferred hatred to love. They preferred their way to God's way. And he was deeply upset by the rejection. So sin here is seen from God's perspective as people just turning their back on him, saying, we don't want your protection. We don't want you to tell us what to do. We will find our own way. We have our own views of what should be. And so God is not punishing them. You know, God didn't visit destruction on them. They visited it on themselves. It was self-inflicted. And I can imagine as the Roman soldiers poured into Jerusalem, putting people to the sword, I can imagine some of the people there looking up to God and saying, where is God? Why has God allowed this? Why has he done this to us? Where is God? Well, I tell you where God is. He's up there on the hillside 30 years earlier, looking down at his people and crying. I wish that you knew the time of your visitation so that you would turn away from the direction you're going and have the peace that I want to give you. And then in Acts of the Apostles, in chapter 2, Peter has been talking. This is why it starts oddly. When the people heard this, he had given a long ish sermon on why Jesus has come. It's the Feast of Pentecost. All the people who are of the Jewish faith had come from many parts of the world to this festival. And as they were stood there, he had delivered this sermon telling them how the whole of the history of Israel had led up and has been preparation for the coming of Jesus. But instead of welcoming Jesus as God's son, they had taken him and they crucified him. And looking at the congregation, Peter says, and you did it. You crucified Jesus. And so there's this idea again of God sending his son to reveal himself to them, to call them to himself. And instead of embracing his message, what had they done? They'd accused him falsely, delivered him up to the Romans to be crucified. Now many of those listening and looking at Peter on that occasion would not actually have been there when Jesus was crucified. And yet Peter says, but you're responsible. And the thing we want to say is, well, that's a bit unfair, isn't it? They weren't even there. You know, it wasn't their voice that shouted crucify. It wasn't their hands that held the sword that arrested Jesus. It wasn't their fingers that closed around the nails and then the hammer as they beat the nails into his hands and feet. It wasn't their whip that lashed his back. How on earth are they responsible? Well, John Donne, who was the Dean of St. Paul's Cathedral in the 17th century, I think it was, wrote this wonderful piece of prose, and I think it bears within it the answer to that question. And he writes this, and you'll probably immediately recognize it. He says, no man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if a man of thy friends or of thine own were. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind, and therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. And there's that word in that wonderful piece of prose. I am involved in mankind. In other words, I share that one thing in common with everybody else, is that I am part of this vast thing called humankind. I share something in common with everybody. Not only the good things like love and an appreciation of beauty and things like that, but also the bad things. Pride, hatred, violence, greed, selfishness. And so when Peter says to a crowd of people that they crucified Jesus, even though they were not present then, they understood that they were just as culpable because they were part of the same people that did it. And I'm not saying the Jews, because that became a thing throughout the centuries. Oh, they blame the Jews because they crucified Jesus. It's their fault. No. That was called projection. That was saying, I'm not guilty. They are. But actually, what John Donne is saying is, I'm involved in mankind. We are all responsible. It's that spiritual, isn't it? Were you there when they crucified my Lord? And the answer, of course, is yes, I was there. It doesn't matter where I am in terms of history or geography or race, I was responsible. It was my sin that crucified Jesus. So their sin is seen as a weakness in us, if you like, that enables us to pander or give in to the darker side of our human nature. And if we didn't actually hold the nails, we, in a sense, put him on the cross. It was our sin that did it. The sin that he came to die for, to rescue us from. Jesus came to save the world throughout time, to save us from that road of self-destruction that if we are not held back, will lead to nuclear holocaust. You know, the killing of vast numbers of people. And this last passage is from Deuteronomy. It's about the commandments. Last Thursday I went to with a local Baptist minister up to Kevincoyd Hospital. He wanted somebody who knew his way around there, and he needed to talk to a couple of people who'd shown an interest in the Christian message. So I took him up to the ward, and as he got talking to these two men, a girl came and sat beside me who was the girlfriend of one of the men, and we got chatting, and I said, well, look, if you're curious, because she was showing an interest, if you're curious, go and sit with them. Go and join in, because, you know, he'll be more than happy to share the message with you as well. But she says, no, she was put off by Christians a long time ago. A friend of hers became a Christian, a born-again Christian, as she called him, and she completely changed. She said she wouldn't come out. I said, let's go out for a few drinks, you know, just a little time together. And she said, no, I'm not allowed to drink alcohol. I'm not allowed to smoke. And if I do any of those things, God will be angry with me. And this girl said, well, I can't believe in that. That's so unfair. Well, you know, I can't believe in a God who's angry all the time at you. And it put her off. And you can understand why. Because God here is portrayed as a wrathful God who punishes the least breaking of the least of the laws. It's all about rules and regulations. And if you break one of them, step across the line, you will be punished. But that's wrong. Steve Chalk tells about, used to be on GMTV, he talks about a time when he did a Radio 5 live show where they discussed various issues. And he said that as he started, the presenter said to him, why is God so miserable? And then she sort of got wound up in a kind of rant, he says. And she says, don't do this, don't do that, don't commit adultery. It's pathetic. And Steve Chalk says, well, I interrupted. I said, well, hang on a minute. Does the Bible say don't commit adultery? And she said, well, of course it does. He said, well, I've never read that bit. And she said, well, you know it's there. It's there twice. It's in the commandments. Oh, he said, I know what you're talking about now. It's just that I didn't recognize it at first because of the tone of voice you were using. She said, what do you mean? Steve Chalk said this. He said, you're absolutely right. God does say that we should not commit adultery. but not in the way you've read it. You see, before he gives any of the Ten Commandments, he introduces himself as the God who loves Israel. He wants them to know that he is for them, not against them. He wants the best for them. God didn't sit in heaven making a list of all the things he knows human beings like to do and then outlaw them all to spoil the fun. Rather, he knows the pain and the heartache that we will cause others and ourselves if we pursue agendas that are contrary to the way that he made us to be. The Ten Commandments is a loving God saying, look, I am the God who loves you. I'm on your side. I got you out of slavery. I'm the best thing you've got going for you. Trust me. Don't steal. Don't lie. Don't abandon me. Don't commit adultery. Because if you do, it will unleash destructive powers that will slowly overshadow you, destroying you, your families, and your society. Trust me. Don't be stupid. Isn't that a different way of looking at the commandments? Not just a list of thou shalt nots, but a kind of a way of offending God. You know, don't offend me. But a way of God saying, look, I love you. And I know that unless I give you directions in life, you're going to hurt yourself and you're going to hurt others. Do not commit adultery isn't just about you, it's also about others. Love me, love your neighbor as yourself, and you will enjoy a life in all its fullness, in a stable environment, in a peaceful society. So if we look at sin, you see, from God's perspective, then we see things in a wholly different way. God doesn't so much say, thou shalt not, as don't. You know, like a child pleading with its, a parent pleading with a child, oh, don't do that. You know, you'd only hurt yourself. Please, make sure you come in on time, just in case something will go wrong. Don't tell lies, because, you know, nobody will trust you. No, I won't know if you're telling the truth. How can I do anything for you if you're going to keep on telling lies? And so sin, it takes on a whole different meaning if you see it from God's perspective. Because when he says, do not sin, he means do not hurt yourself, do not hurt society, and don't hurt me. Let's pray.